my all-time favorite Southern expressions is "they done me wrong." And there's a lot of "they done me wrong" songs in country music. It sounds to my ear so much sweeter than "they have wronged me," which is probably the proper English. "They have wronged me," but "they done me wrong" sounds just so much better. You know, certain people God puts in our lives that do us wrong over and over and over again, right? And there are times when we are moved to separate ourselves from those kind of people, and sometimes rightfully so in the case of genuinely evil people. But sometimes we're too quick to erect barriers against people like that instead of reaching out in love to those folks who, I like to use the word, terrorize us. We ought to move toward them with compassion and love. The hard part of that is deciding when you move toward somebody in love, even though they done you wrong repeatedly, or, you know, when you have to, for your own mental and spiritual and sometimes physical safety, put those boundaries up. If you would think that Jesus would have put the Pharisees in they done me wrong category and have nothing to do with them by this time, right? Those of you that have been following week after week through the book of Luke, you know that from the very beginning they're after him, right? They're persecuting, they're trying to find something wrong, they're upset because he's upset their apple cart, right? He's bringing a message of grace and forgiveness, and he's claiming to be the Messiah, and they want no part of that. They want to stay in their prideful legalism. They want to stay, they want to keep their control over the people. The Pharisees were very respected. They were the Bible scholars of the time, and so they have no place for Jesus except to try to get rid of him. And we already know that they're plotting his murder. So as he's going along on his way toward that last Passover in Jerusalem, maybe 3 to 4 months left of life, he gets invited out to lunch. Now, some of you who are very astute and actually read your bulletin will notice that the sermon title is "Dinner Conversation at Its Best." I don't know why I used the word dinner. It has nothing to do with dinner. It's lunch. Okay? So I'd just like to get that out of the way for those of you that would get a bad attitude over that. It's lunch. A Pharisee invites him for lunch. Let's look at it. Chapter 14 of Luke, beginning in verse 1. One Sabbath, we're not told how this fits into this time. It's kind of a random thing. When he went to dine at the house of a ruler of the Pharisees, they were watching him carefully. My wife sometimes warns me when we're going out to eat with somebody to mind my manners, which what she really means is mind her manners, because she has a higher standard of manners than I do, which is good, which is an okay thing, and some of you husbands can probably identify with that. But anyway, they are watching him carefully as he arrives for lunch at this Pharisee's house. And behold, verse 2, there was a man before him who had dropsy, and Jesus responded to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they remained silent. Then he took him and healed him and sent him away. And he said to them, "Which of you, having a son or an ox that has fallen into a well on a Sabbath day, will not immediately pull him out?" And they could not reply to these things. Well, that's our first section here. You would think Jesus would say, "No, sorry, you know, already have another lunch appointment. Don't want any more of what you guys are trying to do to me." But he goes. He goes. Jesus is always willing to take any and all opportunities to get the truth out, to get his message out, and especially to these people who had deceived the common people for so long. So he hangs out with the Pharisees and he hangs out with tax collectors, which were the worst of the worst, and prostitutes and other sinners. And Jesus is just an equal opportunity guy, moving toward people in love all the time. So he goes to dine at the house of this ruler. And the first thing I want you to note, you know, a casual reading may not reveal this, but this is a setup. This is a setup. The guy is a plant. Sometimes we call these guys ringers, but that's more in the sports realm. This guy is a genuine plant. And let me tell you why he's a plant. Okay? First of all, you already saw that they are watching him carefully. They invite him on the Sabbath, and in the Sabbath there are way more rules than normal for not only for eating, but for life in general. And you're not supposed to heal on the Sabbath. Unless, this is their tradition, this is not the scriptures, unless the guy is on his deathbed. If he's going to die, everybody thinks he's going to die, then the doctor was allowed to treat him. But otherwise, anybody who was sick could just wait. Okay? So they bring this guy in, and the reason we know for sure he's a plant is because Pharisees only invited people of their own kind to eat with them. We're going to see that even more clear in just a few verses down. They would not invite this guy. The man with dropsy, which we know today as edema also, it's a water retention. And when your body retains fluids, the fluids are not a disease in themselves, but they're being caused by other diseases like liver failure, kidney failure, or heart failure. And so because these main organs of your body are failing, your body is filling up with fluid. And the bloating often indicates heart failure. Okay, so that's the definition of dropsy. And I give you that definition because these guys would not have come within 20 feet of a guy with dropsy normally. Okay, remember that if you're sick, according to the Pharisee mentality, God is punishing you. Not only that, this guy is unclean. He is oozing liquid, and so he's unclean. He is obviously a plant, and you know that also by verse 2, where it says, "Behold, there was a man before him who had dropsy." As soon as Jesus comes in the door, this guy is there. Okay? So all they're doing is seeking an occasion to trip up Jesus. And then, in verse 3, we see Jesus responding. What's he responding to? Nobody said anything. What he's responding to is what he knows they're trying to do. See? He knows their hearts. And so he asks them that question. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or no? Is it lawful to do that? And so, you know, Jesus is so good at this that they were always trying to trip him up, and he just puts it back on them. If they say, yes, it's lawful to heal on the Sabbath, they're going against their own rules, which are not the Bible rules, but their own rules, and they will be accused by their own who are gathered at this lunchtime by being soft on legalism. Soft on their religion. If they say yes, it is. If they say no, it is not lawful, then Jesus can take them to the Old Testament where God gives the rules for the Sabbath and say, see, it doesn't say anything about that. So that's why they stay silent. That's why they remain silent. And then Jesus takes the guy and heals him. And notice he sends him away. Jesus knew that the guy didn't really belong there. He was not an invitee to this lunch gathering. And in Jesus' mind, this guy doesn't have to be there, right? He doesn't need to be there. He's already fulfilled the purpose. that they had erroneously planned for him, but now Jesus fulfilled his own purpose with him. He just turns the table on the Pharisees. Well, you know, people think, gosh, Pastor, Galilee is a long distance from Elizabethan. How does that apply to us? Well, there are three main issues. There's three main issues that Jesus deals with during this lunchtime with the Pharisees. And the first one is the issue of hypocrisy. Under the seeming niceness of hospitality, the man invites Jesus to his home just to catch him doing something wrong. What is that? Well, that's hypocrisy. And you say, well, that's not me. I would never do that. I would never do something like that. Let me throw these questions at you that I got from a fellow by the name of Alistair Begg. Okay? Number one, have you ever concealed your bad feeling for someone under the disguise of a smile? Have you ever concealed your bad feeling for someone under the disguise of a smile? See, they're concealing something from Jesus under the disguise of, come over for lunch. We'd love to have you, Jesus. Right? Here's another one. Have you ever concealed your bad intentions for somebody under the disguise of friendship? Come on over, Jesus. Be our friend. Here's another one. Have you ever invited someone into your home for what you could get from them under pretense that it was because you wanted to give them something? That brings it a little closer to home, doesn't it? And then, finally, have you ever faced the possibility that you came to worship today? Not to listen to the Bible, but to find some kind of fault in the music or the prayers or the preaching. But not to really hear what God had for you today. See, those are all matters of the heart that Jesus continually attacked these guys, because they were all about the outward show, the outward formality. They wanted to be respected. They wanted people to like them. In their own group, they were clawing over each other for status. And we're going to see that again in just a minute. Jesus said, the hypocrisy here is not, it's that they can't get, well, let me put it this way. Can you imagine inviting a guy over so Jesus can heal him, just so you can accuse Jesus? I mean, don't we get excited when somebody gets healed in a good way? Isn't that a positive thing? And remember, this is not the first time they have done this. Jesus healed the guy with a withered hand on the Sabbath. I think that's in Luke chapter 6. And they were ripping mad. It says that they were angry and tried to figure out how they could get rid of Jesus. He healed the lady who was bent over on the Sabbath. And again, it produced not joy, not thankfulness, not, man, this lady got healed. She's been bent over for 16 years. No, it's not supposed to happen on the Sabbath, right? There's no mercy. There's no grace. There's no love. There's just this animosity toward Christ that sometimes we see in our own culture today, right? That seems just like unexplainable. Why do you hate Jesus so much? But that was a hard thing for them. And so Jesus gives them the trick question. Well, if we say no, you know, we're going to come across as calloused, heartless people. If we say yes, we're going to come across as soft on sin, right? So they did the only thing they could do. They remained silent. So Jesus reveals their hypocrisy further by asking them this question. Look at verse 5. Which of you having a son or an ox that has fallen into a well on the Sabbath will not immediately pull him out? Well, they had exceptions to all their rules, right? And they would do that. If your ox fell into the well, and by the way, Palestine was full of wells, and there were, you know, just some of them were just holes in the ground, and they were not marked. And so animals and people were all the time falling into these deep wells, right? So if your ox falls in, you're going to pull him out. They allowed for that. If your son falls in, well, my son fell in. I'd give him a couple hours in there first. No. Thank you, Ryan. Have him learn his lesson. No, you go and you pull him out right away. Jesus says if you're willing to offer mercy to your animal and your son, why can't I heal this very sick man on the Sabbath? Well, again, you get the sounds of silence in verse 6, right? They cannot reply to those things. So that's the first issue that Jesus deals with, hypocrisy. And hypocrisy will tie people in knots because they can't be consistent. That's what Jesus was saying here. You can't be consistent in your hypocrisy. And so I have to examine my own life often for that. Well, by the way, I forgot to tell you that the word that is used for they watched him in verse 1, verse 1, they were watching him carefully. That literally means they watched him with suspicion. They watched him with suspicion. They were kind of lurking for him. We had a guy in St. Pete years ago, Dr. Paul Bearer. Look him up on YouTube sometime. He was the guy that introduced the monster movies on Friday night at 11:30. And, that was his name, and he had this gravelly voice, Dr. Paul Bearer. You remember Dr. Paul Bearer? Okay. He's still on YouTube. You can see him. And Dr. Paul Bearer's closing line was, "I'll be lurking for you." And so that's what these guys were doing. They were lurking for Jesus, and as usual, he turns the tables on them, and this is where, hypocrisy and unbelief take them to a place where they have nothing to say to Jesus. Okay, he's turned the tables on them again. Well, let me move on to the next issue. That's the first issue, the issue of hypocrisy. He moves from there to the area of humility. Humility versus pride. He tells them a parable, and remember, a parable is an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. You're trying to get across a spiritual message, you're trying to get across a spiritual principle, but you tell it, you try to explain it with an earthly story that people are familiar with. So Jesus brings in the whole idea of a wedding feast, and he brings up this idea. Well, you can almost see after he turns the tables on them, it's like, oh, darn, he got us again. Oh, well, let's eat, right? Jesus comes in. There's this interaction with the guy with dropsy. The guy with dropsy leaves. Jesus confronts them with their hypocrisy. They can't say anything. So, okay, let's eat, right? Let's eat. And so there begins a mad scramble for the best seats. Now, we have solved this in our culture. When we invite people to a fancy dinner, what do? We use name cards, right, at the tables. But even in our own culture, usually, there's people at the head table, and they're the most honored people, right? And then the tables closest to the head table, they're honored too. And the further back you get, you get back into the nosebleed seats, then, you're kind of like the riffraff. Right? That's where I usually sit, way back there. Anyway, so we understand what is happening here. But the Pharisees, man, this was an art form for them. They had this thing where you would invite people for dinner, so they would invite you for dinner. See? And the higher you were, and you tried to work your way up this class strata at the dinners to be closest to the seat of honor, which was the host. Now, picture a huge U, okay? A U. picturing a U. The host sat in the middle at the bottom of the U. Okay? So the places of honor went out from there. If you got to sit on his right hand or his left hand, man, you were really being honored. But the farther you got away from that bottom of the U, that was bad. See? So when you went to dinner, Jesus is seeing here, it's time to sit down, and these guys are all scrambling for the best seats. Now, here's what they did. They ate in these three people couches. They were called mental blank. What were these called? Triclinium. Triclinium. I'm sure all of you will remember that forever. These three people couches. And so there's this three people couch at the bottom of the U, you know, right there, the host with the two most important people next to him. And then there's these three people couches throughout the rest of the U. See, and they, remember, they laid on their left elbow with their feet away from the table and their head toward the table, this low table. And so you wanted to get in on the tricliniums that were closest to the host. All right? So, Jesus says, verse 8, when you're invited by someone to a wedding feast, notice just to be nice, he takes it out of the present situation. He envisions a wedding feast. Do not sit down in the place of honor, lest someone more distinguished than you be invited by him, and he who invited you both will come and say to you, give your place to this person. And then you will begin with shame to take the lowest place. That is called, in our vernacular today, that's called the walk of shame, right? Here you are, you chose one of the top spots, the host comes by and says, Warren, sorry, we're going to have to get you to move down. Well, by then, what? By then, all the other good seats are taken, so you got to take the worst seat, furthest away from the host. Right? And you can see how ridiculous this was. This is the kind of stuff that they thought was important in life. Right? And Jesus is dealing with their pride. See, their pride kept them away from acknowledging who he was. That he was the Messiah that had come to die for them, pay for their sin. Now, their pride was, no, we're Pharisees. Jesus, you know, we don't know about him. He hangs out with all these weird people, and we don't like him. Now, this issue of pride is one that we all struggle with, right? You know, is there anybody in this room that has not, at some time or another, struggled with the issue of pride? I can remember, you know, it is fixed in my mind, the first time that one of my sons outran me. Now, I had always been pretty fast over a short distance. 100 yards, you know, there are very few people that could outrun me. And that was a point of pride. And I remember I was about 45 years old. We had moved to Wisconsin, and we were all going to some kind of church function at a park, and I challenged all my sons to a race. And one of my sons beat me. And I was destroyed inside. I didn't show it. But I was destroyed inside. I thought, man, it's all over for me now. It's all over. I was 45 years old. We also used to do, at least with the boys in my family, you know, my wife and my daughter were often embarrassed when we did things like this. But I remember being at a park in Wisconsin, and we had all rented bikes. And there was a boat ramp there that went down into the lake. And so I said, let's see who can get the furthest, go down the boat ramp into the lake on your bike, and let's see who can get the furthest out before the water stops us. Right? We were always coming up with these kinds of challenges to each other. And some of you ladies are looking at me like I have a hole in my head, but you don't understand male pride. You don't live with male pride. All the guys know what I'm talking about. Okay, so we did that. You know, and my wife and my daughter are sitting on the shore and some people come by and they're like totally embarrassed that we're doing this kind of stuff, right? And they're like, we don't know them. we don't know them at all. So we used to do that kind of stuff. John Ortberg, who is one of my favorite pastors and authors, tells a story on himself about the same kind of thing. Sometimes our pride is just that you know, that general pride about I can do this, or I'm good at this physically, or I'm good at music, or I'm good at, you know, school, or I'm good at whatever, and we build our self-esteem on that instead of the fact that, you know what, the only reason I'm important is because God saw fit to send his son to die for me and then came to live inside of me when I received his son as my savior. That's the only reason, the one and only reason I'm important. God thought I was worth it. Everything else is just stuff, right? But the pride can be sneaky. And John Ortberg, by the way, he's the guy that wrote the book that has my favorite book title of all time, Everyone's Normal Till You Get to Know Him. Okay? Everyone's Normal Till You Get to Know Him. I think there's incredible insight in that. That book title. Anyway, he says, we were with friends in an open-air street fair when we spotted a mechanical bull. How many here have ridden a mechanical bull? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay, about 11 of you have ridden mechanical bulls. God bless you. Man, that's impressive. Okay, so the guy operating the bull said, watching isn't nearly as fun as riding. So I told the bull operator that I wanted to ride. He took one look at my middle-aged body and asked, are you sure? That guaranteed that I was going to not back down. Okay, again, that's a male thing. All right. He explained to me that the bull has 12 levels of difficulty. 12. It might not be easy, he said, but the key is you have to stay centered on the bull. You have to follow the bull. You have to flow with the bull. You have to shift your center of gravity as the bull moves. So I got on the bull, he says. It started slow, and then it started moving faster and jostling around, and I was holding on real tight. Then I remembered his advice, so I loosened up, and it kept moving faster and jolting and bucking and jumping. I was hanging on sideways. My arms were flailing around all over the place. I just hung on, and finally, the bull slowed down, and it stopped, and I was still on the bull. It wasn't pretty, but I had made it. I imagine how surprised the operator of the bull would be that I had triumphed. So I looked over at him, and he looked over at me. Shaking his head, he smiled and said, nice job. That was level one. That's such a... You know, that's such a male thing. But we have pride about all kinds of different things. Pride causes fighting in our home, doesn't it? Think about it. Think about the times you fought with your husband or your wife, and pride says, you know, I deserve better than this. Or pride says, I'm tired of being overlooked. Or pride says, it's about time somebody recognized me. You shouldn't have done that to me. Right? It's all about pride. Well, here's what Jesus said about pride. Verse 11, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Total opposite than what we think, right? We think, I got to climb the ladder, I got to do this, I got to do that, I got to let everyone show how wonderful I am. And who is the unstated humbler and exalter in that principle? Well, it's God. It's God. Later on, James and it's also in 1 Peter, they made statements like, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, and he will lift you up. He will lift you up. Right? James 4, 7 and 1 Peter 5 something. God is the one that does that. But the Pharisees, they were trying to do it on their own. Right? I got to be quick. I got to get that best seat. And Jesus said, there's a very different way to live. Let me have you keep your finger here and look with me in Luke 17. Just go a couple pages past where you are. Luke 17, verse 10. I remember being in Bible college when I saw this verse for the first time and the impact it made on my life because, you know, we all have this thing where we want to get credit for what we do, and I was no different than anybody else. I wanted to get, you know, if I did something good, I wanted to get credit for it. I want somebody to notice. But here's what verse 10 says. Again, Jesus talking. So you also, when you have done all that you were commanded, say, we are unworthy servants. We have only done what was our duty. Isn't that something? It's a totally different way of looking at life and why I do the things I do. Just a servant. And the word is slave. We don't like to use that word in America, but the word is slave. I'm just an unworthy slave. The master told me what to do. I did it. I don't deserve anything else. I just did my duty. Well, that's true Christian humility. True Christian humility. Instead, you know, I'm tired of being overlooked. This Lord, help me to serve people around me today. Thanks for another day to serve you. So don't push yourself to the front. Jesus said it's ugly. The last issue that he deals with is the issue of hospitality. Hospitality. Back to 14. Look in verse 12. He said also to the man who had invited him. Okay, now he's talking to the host. And these are not the kind of words you normally say to a host. But again, Jesus was not the normal guy. When you give a dinner or a banquet, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind. Very different from the first set of four. And you will be blessed because they cannot repay you, for you will be repaid at the resurrection of the just. Okay. Now, when we set ourselves to reading the Bible and applying it and understanding it, it demands that we have a brain, right? It demands that we use common sense. And so Jesus is not here saying, don't ever invite your friends, right? You read that and you say, what? Don't ever invite my friends to dinner? What? Don't ever invite my family? Okay, I can live with that. No. All right, some of you would feel that way, right? No, he's not saying don't ever invite them. He's saying along with them, here's the kind of people you need to invite. Who's he talking to? He's talking to a group of people who only invite the people in their clique to dinner because everybody else is beneath them in their pride. They want the respect of the common people. They want the greetings. Jesus said you love the greetings in the marketplace. You love people to think highly of you, but inside you're like dead men's bones. Okay? So these are people who just did this thing of reciprocity. You invite me, I invite you. It's just us together. We don't associate with the riffraff. Right? Sadly, some Christians act that way today. Because let's face it, some people are easier to be with than others. Right? I mean, we all have our likes and dislikes. And some folks are just plain more difficult to be with. Right? So, you know, are we excluding those folks from our lives just because it's a little harder? Jesus said, if you do it this way, you'll be blessed because they can't repay you. You'll be repaid at the resurrection of the just. He's looking to what Paul calls the judgment seat of Christ in 1 Corinthians 3, where it's a judgment for believers to determine the level of rewards, not to determine destination. So, Jesus is saying, here's the principle. Don't be selfish in your use of hospitality. You know, why do you invite the people that you invite? Think about that. Use your stuff as an opportunity to serve others. The first time I was ever knowingly confronted with this issue, I say knowingly because I've never been a deep thinker, and things have to hit me kind of in the middle of the head for me to get it. I was a pretty new Christian. I'd probably only been a Christian about a year. And I was part of this very vital youth group. And I was invited as part of this youth group, or a portion of that youth group, I was invited over to Dr. and Mrs. Price's home during one of the holidays of the year. Dr. and Mrs. Price happened to live just a few blocks away from a military school called Admiral Farragut. Admiral Farragut was one of those schools where people sent their kids when they didn't know what else to do with them. Okay? I mean, this is what it was. Sorry, but that's what it was. There are some military schools that are real military schools. Admiral Farragut was not. It was a dumping ground for troubled kids. Many of those kids came from South America, Central America. So I was invited because the Prices knew that I spoke Spanish, and I could interact with these kids who they invited. They would do that at every holiday because these were kids who either their parents didn't have the money to bring them home for a holiday, or their parents didn't want them home from a holiday. So the Prices would invite all the ones from the school who were there alone on a holiday over to their house. And then they would invite kids from the youth group to witness to them. And that was the first time that I ever witnessed to somebody in Spanish. These were kids that could not reciprocate to the Prices in any way. They could not invite the Prices anyway. They could not give the Prices money. They could not do anything for the Prices. The Prices just did that. They had a nice home, had a large home. He was some kind of medical doctor, I don't remember what. Had a real nice large home, and they could put a lot of people in that home. So they, as believers, they asked themselves, how could we use our home for God? How could we use hospitality to impact eternity? And that's what they would do. And those were some of the funnest times for us as part of that youth group to interact with those kids. And the kids were just hungry for love. You can imagine these kids who had just been dumped there and sort of forgotten. They were just hungry for love and attention. And I believe someday we're going to meet some of those kids in eternity. So that was the first time I saw this kind of thing demonstrated that Jesus is talking about. Invite the ones that can't repay you, he says. Get out of this rat race of trying to upmanship and better one another, and you invite me and because I invite you, and get away from that and look for some people who are needy, some people who truly cannot do anything for you in return. So the three issues we've looked at today: hypocrisy. Are we prone to it in some area? Am I prone to it? Humility. Sometimes I think I'm really far from humility. And then hospitality. Are we reaching out with our homes and our food and our friendship to people who are needy? Let's pray. God, as we look at